Hi, I'm Norm Shealy. NormShealy.com. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness this night, and thanks for listening. Tonight, I have with us Dr. Jan Troop with SpectraCell Laboratories, and we're going to talk about his work with lipoproteins and fish oils, too, before the night's over. How are you, Dr. Troop?
I'm just fine. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time to come on my show.
No problem.
So before we get started, why don't you tell people a little bit about you and SpectraCell and what you do there and where your department is moving with this new work that they're doing.
Okay. In 2006, SpectraCell bought my company called Lipid Labs. My background is actually in organic analytical chemistry, and I discovered this technology that was being developed at Texas A&M University and decided to try to commercialize it. I'm not a lipid chemist, but I learned a lot in the last number of years. But basically took the research that was being done at Texas A&M by Dr. McFarland and his group, and further developed it and produced a commercial product, and that was starting in around 2001. And by 2005, started talking to SpectraCell, and then they ended up buying my company in early 2006. And the test is basically an advanced lipoprotein test, or most people call that advanced cholesterol test, but the fact is it really isn't cholesterol, it's lipoprotein particles, and it's aimed at doing a better job at assessing risk and in treating patients with lipid disorders. Lipid disorders is anyone that really basically has certainly high cholesterol, but a lot of people that don't have high cholesterol. And that's sort of the focus of the test.
So how long have you been doing this at SpectraCell for the average population outside of research? Yeah.
We launched the product and put it into the market in 2005. And ever since I've been at SpectraCell, it's been included as one of our tests that we offer. SpectraCell has, I think, and you've talked to other I'm a chemist, by the way. Other chemists you've talked to other chemists that have developed and are involved with the other testing, the micronutrient test, and I'm the inventor and developer of the cholesterol test.
So, how is it? Does insurance pay for that yet, or is it still too new?
Oh yeah, it has from the beginning. It's covered by Medicare with no deductible. And it's covered by most insurance companies, I think all insurance companies right now,
that's wonderful.
A copay that's reasonable of $15 or $30, depending on which of the two versions of the test you order.
Is the scientific community accepting it yet? Because I think it's fabulous, so don't get me wrong, I'm just curious.
Yeah.
I think they should accept it.
Well, the interesting thing is we do have some competitors, and that I came along actually after three other organizations already launched a test that looked at advanced lipoprotein testing and was able to take what they had done very well and looked at what they didn't do so well. And then I built the LPP test around what I thought were all the advantages. And so I went in that direction. And so at the time, even before we were involved, insurance companies were paying for this test. We have our own what we call CPT codes, which is a reimbursement code, and that's very good. We qualify for several CPT codes, so it's certainly well accepted. The problem, and well, maybe I should state what happened. Back in 2001, we have an organization in the United States called the National Cholesterol Education Program, NCEP. And they launched their ATP3 guidelines, and that ATP stands for Adult Treatment Panel. In those guidelines, they pointed out that 50% of those with a reasonable cholesterol test actually are at risk, and they're missed by the standard testing. And furthermore, 50% of heart attack victims have a normal cholesterol under our current guidelines. And in those same guidelines, they pointed out four different lipoprotein subsets, subgroups basically, that were responsible for many of those at risk that are missed by the standard testing. That kicked off then a number of development projects and sort of directed all of the other people that are in this area, and including LPP tests by SpectraCell.
How is SpectraCell testing different from our standard laboratory test?
Okay, standard test just measures the cholesterol content of what we know is the good cholesterol, which is HDL, and the bad cholesterol, which is LDL. It measures those two. In fact, the standard test actually estimates the bad cholesterol by looking at triglycerides and HDL and then calculating LDL. The problem with that is that it isn't really the cholesterol in the lipoproteins that's the problem. It's the lipoprotein particles themselves. When we say LDL, what we mean, or what that stands for, is low-density lipoprotein. The lipoprotein particle is the culprit. It is what is taken up by what we call macrophage cells and forms foam cells and builds plaque in your arteries. Okay, so that's the process. It takes these particles up regardless of their composition. What we've learned recently is that if you have high triglycerides or even moderately elevated triglycerides, it will dramatically affect the composition of your particle. And so it may reduce the cholesterol content, but increase the triglyceride content of a lipoprotein particle. When that happens, if you're measuring cholesterol alone, you get a falsely low number, when in fact you really want to know how many particles there are. And for a long time we thought, well, we actually used cholesterol as a surrogate marker for lipoproteins because we couldn't measure the particles. But now we can measure the particles. And the LPP test is one of two tests in the world, basically, that measure lipoprotein particles commercially.
So let's talk just a minute about, you did this test on me.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, I think we already talked about, I was surprised at the risk that I have. I wasn't aware of it because I do so many things. So, but, you know, taking this test, I realize that even though I think that I'm pretty healthy, I have a lot more that I can do to make myself better. And I'd like to share some of this with my listening audience to hopefully affect their lives, because if they get this test soon enough, they can help themselves, right?
Exactly. Actually, the truth about, I mean, people think it's, you know, the exercise they do or the diet they eat that controls it all. I mean, those are all very important, and you can definitely change a profile by good diet and exercise. However, to a large extent, what we're stuck with is what we inherit. And that aspect of it is the part that you can't control. And possibly in your case, that's what's led to a less than ideal profile.
So you also attached, and I want to go over some of my numbers in a few minutes, but you also attached a piece of paper that gave me some suggestions of things to do,
mm-hmm.
and some specific supplements that I was deficient in. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about those so people will understand, not necessarily supplement, but the oleic acid in particular. Because I think you told me that you're starting to do a new test that's going to test those levels, right, soon?
Well, actually, you're talking about the micronutrient test, and I'm not an expert in that area.
Oh, okay.
However, the oleic acid, I mean, that's one of many fatty acids. What we're looking at offering, and this is fairly new, it's available by an organization or two in the country, but is to look at the actual distribution of fatty acids in your red blood cells. The reason you want to look at that is, I mean, there are a lot of reasons, but the main one, there's an index that's been determined by a guy named Bill Harris. He's a scientist, PhD, and him and his colleagues have developed this test, and what they've determined is that if your red blood cells have a certain level of omega-3 fatty acids, that mimics what's in your heart muscle. And your typical person in the United States has about 4% omega-3s in their heart, in their red blood cells, which produces or creates about a 2% level in your heart muscle. That would be considered full risk for cardiovascular disease or a sudden cardiac death. Now, if you take omega-3s and you can get that level in your red blood cell up to 8%, and that doesn't take that much. It's about a gram a day of EPA and DHA. Those are the active components of omega-3s. If you can take that amount, it'll actually reduce your risk of sudden cardiac death by 90%.
Really? And how long of a period of time?
Well, in a matter of weeks.
Really?
I mean, you have to continue to take it to always have that protection, but in you will increase your serum levels of omega-3s and your heart muscle in, say, a month, month and a half, maybe, at the max.
That's amazing.
And people are definitely not aware of that. And so that's why we're looking very seriously at this. What it does, sudden cardiac death is defined by as someone that dies within the first hour of a heart attack. And typically the problem there is arrhythmias, a fluttering heart. And they die of that, whether or not they could have been resuscitated. The DHA specifically and the omega-3s changes the electronic configuration in your heart enough that it'll actually improve that aspect and reduce the potential for arrhythmias dramatically.
That's very interesting. So I didn't realize that they affected the electrical stuff that was going on. How does that work on a chemical level? How does oils make the electricity conduct better?
Actually, that's not well understood. What they do know, though, is that you have a potassium, calcium, and sodium channels in the conductivity aspect between nodes in your heart, and the DHA facilitates that conductivity.
Interesting.
But the actual mechanisms are not well known. What they have determined, though, is if they take a culture dish and grow cardiac cells and stimulate it to spasm, if you grow it in the presence of DHA, it will inhibit it. And if you grow it in the presence of EPA, which is the other omega-3 that's common, it will not inhibit it.
Interesting. So do you think that it may... And here's going to be one of those questions that you may not know, and it's okay. Just tell me if you don't. It made me think about it. Since so many people have low levels of that, and so many people are deficient in magnesium and calcium, do you think that that has something to do with the way your body holds on to those two minerals?
Well, I don't know about that, and I'm not an expert in that area. You're right. I don't think as much whether, well, I know that DHA specifically will incorporate in the sheath around your bones and prevent calcium loss. So in that regard, and magnesium would also fit into that formula. In that regard, it may actually prevent it, but I certainly have not read it. We know it inhibits the loss, but we don't know if that's related to this other problem, or at least I'm not aware of it.
If it inhibits loss, then it helps it hang on to it, I guess.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Because one of the things that shocked me about your test is, I don't know if you've read about all this information on transdermal magnesium, but I do. They say it absorbs a lot better and you get a lot more if you do it that way. I do so much of that, you wouldn't believe. So, and I wasn't supplementing orally to kind of as maintenance as I was just pouring this on because I was having palpitations a lot. So I was shocked to find as much as I do every day. I bet I do maybe 400 elemental milligrams of magnesium a day transdermally. So to find out that I was short in it shocked me. But gave me some reasoning about why I was having high blood pressure maybe or some of the other things that I have. I was shocked. I just think it's so interesting and so important. Okay. So you also, another thing that your test talks about is metabolic syndrome.
Right.
Can you tell us about that and what this test will do for, or what this test will tell us if we get it, about metabolic syndrome and potential diabetes, maybe?
Absolutely, yeah. About 25% of the population over 40 years old has metabolic syndrome. That's a staggering situation. Metabolic syndrome in general will lead to what we call insulin resistance, or eventually diabetes. And so we have to look at this very carefully. It's actually based on a number of parameters. To get a diagnosis for metabolic syndrome, you need, at least classically, three of the five risk factors. One is high triglycerides, one is low HDL, one is obesity, one is hypertension, and the last one is high glucose. So if you have three of those five, that's a diagnosis for metabolic syndrome. What the NCEP guidelines pointed out was that also in this mix is a dense LDL profile, and this is where the LPP test can help, because it measures, we measure the triglycerides in the VLDL section of the profile. We look at the density of the LDL, which is very important. And we look at HDL, and even more importantly, we look at the subgroups of HDL. And so we're looking at all of that. And if I can release that information on you, is that okay?
Go ahead.
Yeah, you had two. You had the high triglyceride level and a dense LDL level, and you were very close for a female on the HDL level. So the test showed two of the three possible lipid metabolic syndrome traits. So if you had hypertension, obesity, or high glucose, that would be a diagnosis of metabolic syndrome. And what that does is it changes your risk, say, from high to very high, or from moderate to high. And we would typically, a physician would look at that and he would say, okay, I'm going to raise your risk level, and I'm also going to look at your glucose levels to see if we have diabetes at the present time. And if it's, you know, intermediate or whatever, it gives them a heads up on that. From a lipid perspective, then what you want to do is go and address the lipid aspects that would show up in the LPP test. And what we've, I mean, to begin with, well, you have, well, an elevated, you have over 130 for your LDL. Typically, everyone would like to have an LDL value under 130. So if we put you, say, at high risk, say you were at moderate before this diagnosis and now you're at high risk, as an example, I don't know if you are or not, but say as an example, then we would target 100 for your LDL rather than under 130. But from that, all you really know is that somewhere in the four sections of LDL, that we want to reduce the values. And that's where an advanced test like the LPP test is so important. Not only do we identify the risk by measuring the particle numbers as opposed to the cholesterol, that's being mainly important for risk assessment, but now we've broken down your LDL and your HDL into subgroups, and each subgroup of LDL, for example, has a better therapeutic approach. So what we're seeing in the country now is a changeover by physicians just saying, oh, your LDL is high, I'm going to give you a statin drug or something else, niacin, say, for example, to reduce the LDL. They'll look at a distribution like we have, and they'll specifically address it to your profile. If you'd like, I can go into each of those areas that are important.
Sure, go ahead, because it may help someone else.
Sure. There are the four sections are IDL, which is predominantly remnant lipoprotein. That's a very buoyant LDL section. Then we have the regular LDL 1 and 2, which is buoyant LDL that's not part of IDL or intermediate density lipoprotein. Then we have dense LDL, and that's LDL 3 and 4. And usually in that 3 and 4 segment, we can have another culprit called LP little a, and it has its own level of risk. So initially, your RLP is elevated a little bit. It's not real bad, and your VLDL is elevated. To treat that first third of the profile in RLP, things like fibric acid or phenofibrates or omega-3 fatty acids are very effective.
What is fibrates? I've never heard that phrase before.
Fibrates, the common drugs that are out there today are called Tricor or Trilipix is the newest one. There's a lot of advertising with Trilipix. It's one of the reasons you want to take wheat germ or whatever with fiber because it has fibric acid and it reduces it affects a certain chemical pathway and will reduce your triglycerides. But we found lately that it does that, it raises things like homocysteine and Lp(a), which is not a good outcome. Omega-3s are pretty safe all the way across the board, and they'll definitely reduce that area.
So the question, fiber raises homocysteine?
Fibric acid does.
Oh, okay.
Phenofibrates do.
Okay.
And so Lp(a). I actually was on omega-3s, and I wasn't happy with the value. I wanted it to get my triglycerides down lower, so I went, in addition to the omega-3, went on Trilipix as a phenofibrate. And I noticed my homocysteine doubled and my Lp(a) doubled. And so that went back off of it and it came right back again. So I'm a good example of that aspect.
So let me ask you.
But if you don't have those elevated, then you can go up without causing a problem.
So my homocysteine is it on the edge of being high? It's 5.0.
No, yours is very low. That's a good number.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure about that.
Yeah, no, you're in good shape there.
Okay, so how would you address those lipoprotein for people who have high VLDL naturally? Do you know?
Well,
other than omega-3s, any mineral or amino acids?
Way naturally is omega-3s, absolutely.
Okay. What about minerals and amino acids? Do you know if any of them would affect it?
Not too much.
Okay, interesting.
They're not known to have a major effect on it.
Okay. What about the insulin number? That number on my particular one
looks pretty good shape in your case.
What
that is telling us is if you have a fasting insulin level that's high, it means your body's producing insulin when you really don't need a lot of it because you're fasting at that time.
Uh-huh.
And that may mean that you're what we call insulin resistant and maybe either diabetic or pre-diabetic. So that's a handle at that situation.
Okay.
Especially if you have a metabolic syndrome diagnosis, you want to quickly look at that, but also you'd want to look at glucose to see what was going on.
So if you have a number that's below this pink line, I wish people could see this test. The graph that's below the halfway mark, that's a good thing for the insulin as far as diabetes. You don't want it to be up, right?
Right, but on that graph, we're only looking at lipoproteins.
Okay.
We're not looking at insulin there.
Okay. So another thing I wanted to, where did you get these numbers from? Because some of the doctors that are friends of mine that do conventional medicine asked me that. Where are his patient result numbers coming from?
You mean the reference values or
the
actual values of the report?
The values on the far right-hand side, it says patient result values. What are you comparing it to? Your lab results. What is the comparison?
Well,
how do you know what's the norm, or how do you know what's high or low?
Yeah, these are fairly well known.
Okay.
If we look at the things that aren't well known that have to be determined, but are can be derived from well known numbers, are the numbers for particles or the reference values for particle numbers. There, what we have to look at is a patient that we would call not cholesterol depleted or enriched. That means one with a sort of a medium range triglyceride level. So the lipoprotein particles have sort of the average of the population of, say, 50% cholesterol rather than maybe 40% cholesterol.
Okay.
And if we look at those people, then we can say, okay, we know the cholesterol value, and we can then calculate in the subfraction breakdown, and then we can calculate a reference value in particle numbers. Now, a lot of this is the result of hundreds of papers that have been done in advanced lipid testing in subfraction analysis. So we used a lot of that work as our reference to start with, and then we've established or tweaked our own reference values to fit the population as we understand the standard distributions.
Okay. So can I ask you about lecithin?
About what?
About using lecithin for cholesterol problems.
I know nothing about it.
Okay. If you were going to take an emulsifier, and you may tell me that same answer for this one, but if you were going to use an emulsifier to try to help the triglycerides, would you want to take that with your fish oils or after your fish oils? How would be the best way to get the fish oils in the system?
Really, you don't
sense?
Really need to do anything special. I mean, the fatty acids are taken in readily just in a standard gel cap. You don't really need to facilitate it in any way. What you want to do is to make sure there are several things about the fish oil that are important, and one is that you want as high a DHA level as you can get, because it's about 50% more effective at triglyceride reduction, and you want it in a form that is a triglyceride form, not an ethyl ester form, if you can, because it's more bioavailable from the triglyceride form. The ethyl esters will work, it just takes more of it.
What would a bottle say so you would know what you're to buy?
Usually they don't say that. Usually they say it is the triglyceride form because they're proud of that if it's a purified fish oil.
Uh-huh.
Because they typically have to convert the real fish oil into an ethyl ester for distillation, for purification. And then if they want to, or if they're making a very high quality one, they would convert it back into the triglyceride form, which is more bioavailable.
Okay.
Now, if you eat a fish, straight, you get the triglyceride form. That's the way it comes from the fish. Also, the algal form that's is in baby formulas and some other food products and available. That form is the triglyceride form.
Okay. Does it matter what kind of fish you eat, or does it need to be one of those really fatty fish?
The fatty fish is better. The mackerel, sardines, tunas, salmon, those kinds of fish are much higher than, say, something like tilapia or catfish or things of that, or flounder. In fact, I was just reading, an interesting point is that the farm red fish are mostly fed pellets or grain materials to grow, and they thrive quite well on it, but they don't have omega-3s in them. And so those fish and the farm-raised ones end up having almost no omega-3s. The omega-3 actually comes from algae in the ocean, which is eaten by the krill. And the small fish eat the krill, and the large fish eat the small fish, and that's how you get the omega-3 in a large fish or in a medium-sized fish. But if you farm-raise the fish and you feed them other kinds of carbohydrates and proteins, you don't end up with omega-3s.
Interesting. So what about using things like olive oil or almond oil, things like that? Is that an area that you know?
A little bit. Most of the alpha-linolenic acid ALA products are only converted to EPA and DHA at about a 15% level. So you're much better off if you just go straight to the EPA and DHA.
Okay.
And the DHA is the one that's the most effective across the board and is converted to EPA if your body needs it,
okay,
where the EPA is not converted to DHA.
So could you tell us a little bit about, and I'm looking for this paper, this aspirin test that you do? Were you the one to ask about that?
I'm not an expert in that.
They sent me some literature
on that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an aspirin response test, but I could just give you the very basics. Not everybody responds to aspirin in the same way. And this test, we measure thrioxine, and by measuring this, you can tell if, I mean, you may think, okay, I'm taking a baby aspirin and that's going to protect me. Some people it does, and some people it doesn't. Some people would have to take a whole regular aspirin to get the same effect as someone else that took a baby aspirin.
Okay.
So it's a very valuable test if you're on aspirin therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what other work are you doing? Are you working on anything else that we need to talk, you'd like to talk about?
Well, no, my main function is to develop and explain and discuss the LPP test. So that's my baby.
Okay, I just don't
want
to leave anything.
That's already very complicated. And when you have 50% of the people out there that are at risk that didn't know they were at risk, that's a pretty serious situation.
They sent me a chart, the lipoprotein particle testing therapeutic guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got different treatment protocols. I know we've talked about this a little bit, but you talk about statins and fibrates and estrogens and resins and absorption
right.
inhibitors. What can you tell me? Why, some people, everybody that I talk to, say try niacin. They say, oh, it gives me a terrible headache. Do you know why that happens?
It gives people usually hot flash reactions. That's the downside of niacin. The upside is that it's effective at a lot of the different lipid subgroups. If you're trying to treat Lp(a), for example, it's the only thing that is effective against Lp(a), really. And you have a dense LDL profile, it's extremely good for treating that, where a statin isn't very good at treating a dense LDL profile. Niacin will raise HDL. There are very few things that will raise HDL. So it's an extremely good therapy, and what we're seeing today is that most physicians don't look at a patient and just say, take niacin or take statin or take fish oil. They'll say, you need fish oil and niacin or a statin and niacin or some combination therapy because, as I was mentioning earlier, we have four different areas of the profile, of the LDL section of the profile, each with a better lead therapy. And one therapy does not treat the whole profile.
Could we go over those therapies?
Sure. We sort of started that, and then we got onto something else. But the beginning of the profile, which is RLP, beginning of the LDL, is remnant lipoprotein. You hear a lot about, just a quick story on that, we hear a lot about antioxidants and why they're important. And the reason they're important is they stop the oxidation of LDL. And LDL typically has to be oxidized to be taken up by macrophage cell and form foam cells, which build plaque in your arteries. The bad news on remnant lipoprotein is that it'll actually be taken up and go through that cycle without being oxidized. So remnant lipoprotein.
What does that mean?
That means that it's an LDL particle that will become plaque without going through the oxidation step. So antioxidants are not going to help you there.
Okay,
but antioxidants are very valuable because they do help you on the other parts of LDL. But if you have high triglycerides and remnant lipoprotein, you are at risk, and a statin isn't going to change that too much, for example. Or niacin, mm-hmm. It'll change it some, but not dramatically.
So which one do I have looking at my test?
You have an issue on the triglyceride end, so you should be looking at that, some therapy to handle that. You have a dense LDL profile and a low HDL. So niacin, I mean, if I were going to give you a first-run therapy, and again, I'm a chemist, I'm not a MD, but I would get you on a good heavy dose of omega-3s and try to get you on niacin because it would help all aspects of your profile.
Let me ask you this. I was taking probably 2,000 milligrams of niacin every day before I got this test. So that's another thing I was
talking
about.
So you were already on this when we ran the test?
Yeah. So, but I was taking niacinamide. Does the form of niacin matter, or was my results really probably a lot worse and taking the niacinamide brought it down to where it is?
Well, it does matter. The slow niacin, or not the slow, the non-flesh niacin. Slow niacin is okay. The non-flesh niacin is generally not known to be very effective compared to crystalline niacin or time-release or sustained-release niacins, like some products, or I think one's called slow niacin.
Interesting.
So those are better, and I'm not sure. The prescription drug is Niaspan, and that's a time-release type niacin, and that's very effective.
So the goal is to keep high levels of niacin in your blood kind of constantly?
As long as possible.
Okay.
I know Niaspan peaks out in about 4 hours.
So it's better to take it throughout the day rather than all at one time.
It's better to take it at night so your flush reaction happens while you're sleeping.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I've had that blood reaction, and it, I remember one time I gave it to my child because, you know, Abram Hopper talks about how niacin helps depression, and my teenager got some depression, and I forgot to tell her that there was a thing called a flush with it.
Yeah,
she's not happy.
Yeah, that's the downside of the niacin therapy. It's a very great, it's a very good therapy, but it does have that side effect. But the ones that are compounded as a time release or sustained release kind of form, those are much better, and people tend to tolerate that pretty well.
Okay, now going down to, let's go back to the ones that we've not covered about what to do, the traits.
Well, we've talked about. If you just had a lot of buoyant LDL, in your case, there is a graph, and if you look at the peak is lined up on this vertical line.
Mm-hmm.
So you have about 50% of your LDL peak is dense. The average population is about 30% dense. So you really don't, the denser the LDL means a smaller LDL particle. And the way LDL forms plaque is that those small particles go through pores in the lining of your arteries. And if they're small, they go through those pores more rapidly. They're also more easily oxidized, so antioxidants become more important. And so the small, what we call small dense, it means it's both small and dense, those particles are much more atherogenic or likely to cause plaque than the large buoyant LDL particles. And so what we want to do is shift that profile. We want to reduce it, in your case, reduce the LDL quantity, but shift it to a more buoyant position. And that's why I said niacin, because it will do both of those.
Okay. All right. Anything else that you would do for that particular thing?
For dense LDL?
Would the fish oil help that too?
It will indirectly. Mostly what it's going to do is reduce the triglycerides. But in a metabolic syndrome profile, when that action goes on, it reverses several steps that cause small dense LDL and cause HDL to go to a smaller particle. When you have a small HDL particle and you have a bit of an excess there of the small HDL particles, they're not as effective at removal of cholesterol as the large buoyant ones. Well, in fact, what happens is the small dense ones of the HDL then go through this in and out cells, and they pick up the excess cholesterol. And when they get fully loaded, they become what we call HDL-2B. And that's telling us that the HDL is quite functional. You hit a threshold there. You're just barely under it. But that's the area that was low in your case. Niacin is a good way to raise the HDL-2B and the total HDL. Also, exercise is very effective at raising HDL.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
People never want to hear that part, right?
I don't want to hear that part.
Yes.
Okay, let's see. Oh, let's talk a minute about my doctor one time years ago when I first started getting high blood pressure, somebody said, oh, you need to check your C-reactive protein.
Mm-hmm.
And my doctor said, oh, it's not time to do that yet. Why? I didn't understand that. C-reactive protein?
What we need to think about is the fact that building plaque is a lifelong process. It starts when you're, you know, very young, and it keeps going along. So I guess I don't quite understand that comment, because what C-reactive protein is telling us is that there's inflammation present. It's just not specific. The test is not specific. It could be a head cold. It could be arthritic pain that's causing that type of inflammation. Or it could be some chronic inflammation that is affecting your arteries. And if it affects your arteries and it's part of the atherosclerotic process, then you're getting this penetration of these LDL particles through there, through these pores that are created due to this inflammation process. So we want to look at CRP, C-reactive protein, to determine whether we have that situation. However, if it's a high value, you really want to look at it over a period of several weeks or months to see if it was maybe due to a head cold at the time.
Okay.
Because it may be just due to something like that and not due to chronic inflammation.
So the fact that mine is fairly low means that, and I'm asking a question here, does mm-hmm. that mean my arteries are probably not inflamed, even though they may be filling up with plaque? Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, it means it's not, you're not...
could be worse, right?
Yeah, it could be a lot worse. It's not dramatically inflamed. I mean, but it doesn't mean that plaque process isn't going on anyway.
Okay.
I mean, it can go on, and it usually does, at a very steady, slow process. So everybody has some. You just don't want it to get to a serious situation before you're the age that you end up dying for other causes.
So does that number, I'm just asking you the same question a different way, reflecting my immune system?
That's hard to say, I couldn't really venture an answer
okay.
on that one.
That's all right. I've just thought about it. Now, what is the LPPLA2? Mine's at 157. What does that tell me?
And that's it's actually a test that we've now discontinued from the LPP test because
okay.
The results seem to be a little erratic and we're not comfortable with the air level of it.
Okay.
But what it tells you is it is a test that is specific for vascular inflammation or plaque inflammation and endothelial lining inflammation. So it was very specific to cardiovascular disease. It's like CRP, but it's an enzyme being generated in the plaque formation step. Theoretically,
so that tells
that's
me
a great
that
thing to know.
Some plaque is probably forming then, right?
If it's hot, if it's elevated, I mean, again, probably everyone has plaque forming.
Okay.
It's just a matter of the rate, and you just don't want the rate to be high.
What about this LDL phenotype? What does that tell us? Mine's...
Yeah, that's telling us the same thing that the dense LDLs in our report we show the subgroups of LDL 3 and 4, which are the dense subgroups. And when those are elevated, it's saying that, and I think I remember I mentioned a little bit ago that you had about 50% dense LDL.
Mm-hmm.
The phenotype is telling us the same thing. It's an older terminology, though. People used to want to know if you were a type A or a type I or a type B phenotype, and it was basically the bias of the LDL peak. Is it mostly dense or mostly buoyant or whatever? Now, since we can really nail the subgroups down, that's more informative. But I still have docs ask what the phenotype is, so I put it on the page.
Okay.
And that size or that density can then be related to a size of the particle on an average. But you can have a lot of dense LDL and still have that not be particularly a small size.
Okay, what about nitrates? I think that's the right word, like people that use nitroglycerin.
That's more of a vasodilator, and I'm not an expert there, but the reason you take it is to dilate your vessels so
okay.
that if you have a stenosis or the closing in of plaque to restrict the flow, then it dilates the artery so that the blood can flow more easily through it.
Does it have anything at all to do with, or things like beets, beet juice, it has a lot of nitrates in it. Does that help the triglyceride levels at all?
I'll take your word for it that beet juice has nitrates.
Yeah, we'll assume that.
Okay. I wouldn't know if, it wouldn't really affect triglycerides as far as I understand.
Okay. What about, and you may not know anything here on this particular thing, it just comes to mind, the bile acids and cholesterol, like your gallbladder, and if there's something wrong with that, is that going to be one of the things that makes your cholesterol go up? Maybe the amino acids that support that? Like taurine or carnitine or something?
Yeah. What I can say about, with regard to the bile, we have drugs that are called biosequestrants. And they're really, this isn't exactly the question you're asking, but it's something.
I don't know how to ask it, so help me out.
Yeah, it isn't, when your bile has a lot of cholesterol in it, a ton of cholesterol, okay? So a biosequestrant, and there's a drug called Welchol that's the most common one. What it does is it actually binds up the bile in your gut, and then you eliminate it. And so what you do is you deplete your cholesterol supply by binding up the bile. The nice thing about that particular approach is that it doesn't generally have other complicating factors like muscle pain and things. It's not in your bloodstream like a statin drug or a lot of other therapies. So people that can't tolerate statins or niacin, you know, that's a good therapy for them. It takes a lot of it, though, you have to take quite a few grams of it to be effective.
Do you know if there's some natural thing that will do that?
I'm not aware of
pharmaceutical trying to mimic.
Yeah, good question. I don't know of one right off.
Okay. Because, you know, the reason I asked that question is because, you know, I think I told you I have high blood pressure. And
okay.
I don't want to do pharmaceuticals because of what you said, leg pains
mm-hmm.
and other things, that, you know, muscle pain in your gut and stuff. So I've tried everything because I have all these resources that I ask questions. And when I started doing a lot of beet juice, and I really noticed a difference in my colon.
Okay.
I really did. And I was didn't know what that meant. So I was hoping that...
Yeah, that would be a question for
Jonathan,
an MD that's familiar with the nutritional aspect of it. One thing I could throw out that I've been trying and we've found it to be effective in a few patients, almost everybody that I know that has tried it, and it was recommended by a cardiologist, is polycosinol.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
actually a sugar cane extracted product. And in the dosage range of about 20 milligrams, it's been shown to reduce LDL fairly significantly.
Really? Well, that's another concern for me then, because I've been doing polycosinols for about a year now. So
oh,
I
really?
Wonder what my test would have said if I hadn't have done that. I think
it wouldn't be as nice as it is today.
Yeah, I did a lot of things. So that's why, I mean, I have a supplement basket in there like you have no idea. So it makes me really wonder, you know, what would this test look like? But I know my mother had heart disease or cholesterol mm-hmm. problems up until like her cholesterol was like 2300. So it made me, it at least gave me some kind of something to go by. And I know I get a lot of emails from people with that same problem today.
Well, it's clear from your profile that a lot of things would change if you got the triglycerides down. And so how much omega-3s are you taking?
I wasn't taking anything consistently. Once in a while, maybe once or twice a week, if I thought about it, I would take 1,000 fish oil. But I've now bumped it up to about 6,000. So.
Oh, really? Okay.
I'm going to redo this test through my doctor in a couple months and see what that means. And maybe I'll have you back on and we can show people just how valuable this thing really is.
Dramatic it was.
I would have had no idea.
Well, the NSAID guidelines would tell you that you would need 2 to 4 grams of the omega of the EPA and DHA.
What about... go ahead.
You know, when people take, say, 1,000 milligrams of fish oil, if the tablet says 1,000 on the front of the bottle, that doesn't really tell you what you want to know. What you want to do is look at the label and see how much EPA and DHA there is.
You told me that, and so I actually went and called the company where I was buying mine and
uh-huh.
come to find out it said 1,000, and I was getting maybe 300, if that
exactly.
Means.
So in order to get the dose that you, as a therapeutic dose, would be, say, 4 grams of EPA and DHA, you would need, you know, 12 or something like that of those a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably not what you're taking, right?
No, it wasn't.
Okay,
you know,
in order to actually reduce triglycerides, you need to get in the more than 2, up to at least 4 grams of EPA and DHA.
I've certainly moved it up since I talked to you. Thank goodness for you. I appreciate what you're doing.
Well, I
have know a lot of
qualifying
do.
Things with too. I'm not a physician, but I'm sort of quoting the NSAID guidelines here, and
and
I'm aware of the dosages that are required.
One of the things that I usually say that I haven't said is that, but people on that listen to my show usually know this. This is for information. None of us are medical doctors.
Yeah, we're not trying
to
treat anybody,
but. We can give you information about where to start looking, things to talk to your doctor about.
Absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. This is This is to say, okay, with an advanced test, maybe I'm at risk and I didn't know it some way. And then when you get the test, then it may take another round of discussion to decide on the best possible therapy. But at least you're armed with the right pieces of information.
And I would imagine if you had teenagers, if you ran it on them, or maybe in your early 20s, it would give you a good picture of what it's... I'll be 50 next week.
Mm-hmm.
It'll give you a good picture of what's coming down the road, even if it's not across those borderlines, right?
That's true. And one thing we haven't talked too much about, or only a little bit, was the Lp(a), lipoprotein(a), which is totally inherited.
Which one of those is mine?
That's at the very bottom of the sheet.
Oh, okay.
And it's a small, dense LDL. Okay, so it's one of the bad types. But it also is very prone in many of the genetic variations to cause blood clots. So if as a kid, if you see that you have that indicator, you would want to be more aggressive at controlling cholesterol numbers or lipoprotein numbers. Niacin is about the main therapy for Lp(a). I'm not saying that you never should go on niacin as a child, but you should be aware that your profile has it. And it might require being more aggressive as age goes along.
What about if you're taking this kind of niacin, what about your liver?
That's a concern, and especially if we're starting very young, that would be a concern. For niacin and for all statin drugs, including red yeast rice, which is a statin, just for your audience in case people aren't aware of that, you should monitor liver enzymes.
What does it do to them? Why does it raise them?
I'm not an expert there in the cause. You're inhibiting, with a statin, a thing called HMG, coenzyme A reductase, and that's the production of the ApoB particle, part of the particle.
What does that mean?
It's the step that gets inhibited by a statin, and that is occurring in your liver, okay?
Uh-huh.
But I would guess, and I'm not an expert there, that it also, in the process of inhibiting that production, it might inhibit or stimulate the production of other liver enzymes. One that it does inhibit is the production of CoQ10. So a lot of people find that that they have a CoQ10 deficiency when they're on a statin drug.
Oh, okay. And that's one other thing that I was doing every day. I was doing about 100. I think my CoQ10 levels were okay. But what does CoQ10 do for us? Does it do anything for the cholesterols?
Not too much there, but it feeds your mitochondria, which is your main power plant and your energy part of your cells. It's one of the main components that feeds that energy power plant. So it can really disrupt cell productivity.
Well, it sounds to me, after going over this, for my particular case, that it all has to do with what I'm putting in my mouth. So I don't have a lot of inflammation, I don't guess. My homocysteine's okay. So it sounds like I'm just eating poorly, right?
Well, only about 25% of what we see on this report is from what you eat.
Really?
You inherit the rest. In your case, you mentioned you have hypertension. So that plus the diagnosis here of several metabolic syndrome traits means a diagnosis of metabolic syndrome. So you want to have your LDL under 100, and you're probably not going to get there with diet.
Okay.
You're too far away from that number. So.
Okay. All right, the time's over. Tell us where to find you. Thank you, Dr. Troop. I appreciate you, and I think what you're doing is fabulous. Thank you. And good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health. Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.